If you've ever watched The Colbert Report on Comedy Central, you're probably familiar with something called the Colbert Bump.
The rest of you know that the Colbert Bump is the curious phenomenon whereby anyone who appears on this program gets a huge boost in popularity, causing them to win elections, receive major awards, even get laid.
Stephen Colbert proclaiming the truthiness of the Colbert Bump. Well, now someone has actually taken time to prove that there is, in fact, a Colbert Bump in the real world, and that person is here now. He's Professor James Fowler at the University of California at San Diego. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You actually did a study on the Colbert Bump?
I did. it's funny because, anyone who watches the show realizes that this is all tongue-in-cheek. On the other hand, there's that point where the tongue-in-cheek part of it becomes so well-known that it actually becomes influential. And so I was really just wondering if underneath all of these claims that there was a Colbert Bump, if there actually was a bump.
So how did you do this study?
The very first thing you want to do is you want to compare each person who went on the show to someone who's similar. Someone who's either an incumbent or a challenger, someone who's a Democrat or Republican, and someone who's been earning money at about the same clip as the other person prior to going on the show.
And so what did you find?
Well, so what we found was that there actually is a Colbert bump in campaign donations. When you look 30 days after being on the show, the Democratic candidates earned about 44% more in campaign donations than the matched candidates that we compared them to. And it didn't seem to be much of a bump for Republicans, but we did find one for Democrats.
Professor Fowler, though, wouldn't that be chalked up just to simple publicity, that if any candidate goes on any TV show or makes any public appearance, they're going to get more attention and maybe more political donations?
That's certainly true, but we found a difference for this show between Democrats and Republicans. The Democrats who are willing to go on the show were actually doing much worse prior to coming on the show, which means that they were interested in taking a risk. The Republicans were actually doing much better than average before they came on the show, which means that they had to feel very secure in their campaigns in order to be willing to risk being made fun of by Stephen Colbert.
Although Ron Paul, Mike Huckabee, Stephen Colbert claims both of those Republicans got the bump.
Yes. They were both polling at 1% before they went on the show, and Huckabee went to 3% and Paul went to 2%. And so they were doubled and tripled, respectively.
That's huge.
That is huge. But what's interesting with these candidates is that you can actually not only look at campaign donations, but you can look at the election outcomes. And this is not statistically significant. So what that means is we can't be sure that it's not a difference due to chance. But the candidates who went on the Colbert Report did get about 3% more in their elections than the matched candidates.
3% more of the votes.
That's right.
So I'm just wondering, since you're a fan of the show, if you didn't do this to kind of get on the show, do you want to be asked on?
I would love to be on the show. And in fact, I was wondering if on the show, if I should do the same thing that Stephen Colbert did for George Bush and say, Stephen Colbert, have a hot dog with me.
I'm not sure he listens to Day to Day, but hopefully he does. And we'll give him the Day to Day bump.
Yes, that would be fantastic.
Okay, great. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Professor James Fowler at UC San Diego. He has written a study called The Colbert Bump in Campaign Donations, More Truthful Than Truthy. The Day-to-Day Bump continues.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Andrea Seabrook. If you're like me, you lost your appetite for fava beans and wine when you heard this.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans. And a nice Chianti.
Ugh. That, of course, is Anthony Hopkins bringing Dr. Hannibal Lecter to life in the movie The Silence of the Lambs. Lecter was born in the mind of crime novelist Thomas Harris, but it was Hopkins who made Hannibal the Cannibal one of the most notorious villains in American pop culture. As part of our series In Character, NPR's Laura Seidel explores how Lecter feeds our fascination with serial killers.
When Anthony Hopkins was first offered the part of the murdering psychiatrist Dr. Hannibal Lecter, he was intrigued.
I thought, oh, it's one of those parts. It's the dark man, the boogeyman at the top of the stairs, which we're all, we all have that from our childhood fantasies, the unknown shadowy person, which is very attractive and erotic as well. But I thought it's one of those parts, and I think I'm going to enjoy this.
I did not kill him, I assure you. Merely tucked him away very much as I found him after he'd missed 3 appointments.
But if you didn't kill him, then who did, sir?
Who can say? best thing for him, really. His therapy was going nowhere.
Lecter is dark, but he's also funny. Hopkins co-star Jodie Foster, who played FBI profiler in Training, Clarice Starling, says she found Hopkins' portrayal frightening, but it was more than that.
He still played the wit of Hannibal Lecter. He played all of the layers of hiding. Instead of trying to, you know, understand whether his parents beat him or whether he was abused as a child, or, you know, instead of trying to make us feel sorry for him, he allowed Hannibal to have that veneer of evil.
And evil he is. Fortunately, in The Silence of the Lambs, Dr. Hannibal Lecter is already in prison for his crimes. This once-respected psychiatrist has killed at least 7 people and eaten them, hence his nickname, Hannibal the Cannibal. Adding to his dark veneer is his home in a dungeon-like cell with no windows in the basement of a mental institution. In most of the film, we see Lecter through the eyes of Agent Clarice Starling, who is sent to get some information from Lecter to help catch another serial killer. Clarice is clearly frightened of him, and yet he takes a mentor-like attitude towards her.
Well, perhaps you'd care to lend us your view on this questionnaire, sir.
No. You were doing fine. You had been courteous and receptive to courtesy. You had established trust with the embarrassing truth about Miggs. And now this ham-handed segue into your questionnaire.
Hopkins has the capacity to just draw you in.
Dr. Helen Morrison is a psychiatrist who has studied serial killers.
Which is a little similar to what a serial killer can do. They draw you in, and then it's like being in a Venus flytrap. It's over.
Plenty of real-life research is behind Hannibal Lecter. Author Thomas Harris was a crime reporter who covered some real serial killers before he wrote The Silence of the Lambs. Anthony Hopkins studied up on them before he played the part. Morrison thinks Hopkins nails certain behaviors and characteristics of the real thing. She has interviewed dozens of them, including Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, and Wayne Williams. Morrison says they can be alluring because they seem so normal. She remembers the first time she met a serial killer.
And I walked into the interview room, and there was this individual sitting there in a powder blue suit. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. I wonder when they're going to bring the serial killer in. And until I realized that this individual sitting in front of me, who looked like Casper Milktoast, was responsible for some fairly horrendous murders.
Only once in the film do we actually see Lecter at his most murderous. One moment he's quietly sitting in a temporary cell listening to Bach's Goldberg variations and preparing to eat a lamb chop dinner served by the guards. The next moment, he has broken free of his handcuffs and eats one of them and clubs the other to death. Throughout, there's no change in his placid expression. But Agent Starling never sees Lecter at his worst. To her, he appears human, and she treats him that way. A sort of bond develops between them. In a strange way, they relate to each other, says Jodie Foster. Lecter is locked away and treated like a lab rat by his jailer. Starling grew up poor and has worked her way up.
She wants dignity, and interestingly, Lecter does too. That's his little thorn in his side, is he wants to be treated with dignity. And if you don't, he'll eat you.
Because of her unique relationship with Lecter, the character, Clarice Starling, comes to feel that he wouldn't attack and eat her. Indeed, when the movie ends, Clarice has caught the serial killer she was out to get, and Lecter has escaped. But he does make a brief phone call to Clarice and a promise.
I have no plans to call on you, Clarice. The world's more interesting with you in it.
So you take care now to extend me the same courtesy.
You know I can't make that promise.
I do wish we could chat longer, but I'm having an old friend for dinner.
Lecter is more than just a bad guy.
He is a fully fleshed character. You know, he's not just a cardboard villain. You see his vulnerabilities. You see that he cares for her in the way that he can, that he has a kindness towards her. And yes, we're seduced by that humanity, by his light touch with her, in the way that you would hope a great dad would be.
She must be kidding. And that's also where Hannibal's character serves the needs of fiction, says Dr. Morrison.
In real life, he never would have become attached to her. You know, I sit with these serial killers for 8-10 hours at a time. And I come back day after day after day. And every time I walk into them, it's as if I were starting all over again.
Morrison says actual serial killers have no empathy. But in Lecter, we get a little sweetness that may be what makes him better fiction and more likable and more enduring. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
There's more about Hannibal Lecter from Jodie Foster. You can find it online at npr.org/incharacter. That's all one word. And while you're there, tell us about the characters who stimulate your appetite. We might just use your comments on the air.
In Atlanta, hip-hop meets ballet tomorrow night.
The Atlanta Ballet's latest show is a collaboration between old-school dance
and new-school music, specifically the beats and rhymes of Antoine Big Boy Patton of the popular Atlanta duo Outkast.
Day-to-day producer Shireen Meraji spent time with the performers while they were fine-tuning the show, simply titled Big.
I be on it all night, man. I be on it all day. Straight up pimp. If you want me, you can find me in the air.
Dance studio doors vibrate to the deep bass of Big Boy's kryptonite. Peek behind those doors and you'll find ballet choreographer Laurie Stallings directing the movements of a crew of young dancers from the Atlanta Ballet. A featherweight ballerina twists and turns above the heads and under the arms of four male dancers. Her movements are ethereal, but it's also like she's teetering over a cliff's edge, right about to fall. Laurie Stallings says Antoine Big Boy Patton's music forces her to say something meaningful with her choreography.
The work is fundamentally based on the contrasts that make up the American dream. I think I've been waiting for this music for a long time, actually. It's like any classical composition. It's intricate and layered and beautiful and ugly, and there's so much texture. So if Mozart was here, I think he'd really dig this.
Dancing in toe shoes to a song about smoking weed is definitely a contrast. Atlanta Ballet's artistic director John McFall said when he was first floating the idea of collaborating with a hip-hop act, patrons were a little freaked out about the lyrics.
So people were pushing back pretty hard at times. You know, it's not a fairyland. Alcohol and drugs are part of our lifestyle, whether they're legal or not. There is some pretty interesting language in some of the tracks that we're using. You know, that's representative of a culture, and I actually call it poetry.
I must admit, they planted a lot of things in the brains and the veins of my strain. Makes it hard to refrain from the host of cocaine, from them whores, from the flame, from a post in the game. Makes it hard to maintain focus.
Rehearsals for Big are an aural and visual culture clash, with Stallings, a wisp of a woman standing 5 feet tall, no more than 100 pounds, explaining her choreography to hip-hop lyricists like Big Rube, heard here on Outkast Liberation. They call him Big Rube for a reason. He's at least 5 times Stallings' size, baggy jeans, gold chain, and you can't leave out the shiny gold mouth grill.
A dancer comes on stage and they're making graffiti on stage, they're painting, and you walk through that environment as he's doing his work.
Right. Maybe the rough edginess of hip-hop is now, you know, definitely being accepted as a legitimate art form, and anybody who maybe isn't seeing that, you know, the writing's on the wall. You know what I'm saying? Something like that, maybe.
Fantastic.
The obvious writing on the wall is that the fine arts like ballet aren't doing well financially. Patrons are getting older, and ballet companies need to attract newer, younger audiences. And in Atlanta, hip-hop is king. Think Ludacris, T.I., Little John, Jermaine Dupri, and of course, Outkast.
Yeah, international, underground, thunderbowls, and I stomp the ground like a million elephants, a silverback, orangutan, you can't stop a train.
They are the super talented and innovative hip-hop duo. Hip-hop icons, really. When NPR's diplomatic correspondent Mike Schuster claims to have one of their CDs, you know they've crossed over. And if you've forgotten their names, here's a reminder. Andre 3000 of Hey Ya fame and Antoine Big Boy Patton. He likes the way ballet dancers move.
the music in itself has no boundaries. So ballet could be thrown in anywhere. You know what I'm saying? Because we utilize every genre of music, from heavy metal to hip hop to reggae to jazz to country to folk to gospel. You know what I mean? So why not?
It's 10 p.m. when Big Boy arrives for work at his Atlanta studio, where friends and family like his Uncle Mooney and Cousin Tafani chill in the back room, known as the Courvoisier Lounge. His conclusion? Art is art. And regardless of race and social class, hip-hop culture and ballet culture aren't so different.
They come to the studio, and we sit in this room right here and go through music. It's like that mental sign language that Laura and Big Rube were intertwined in. Me and Laura do the same thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, oh, I can see her. She's very animated. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, without even saying words, we can kind of connect and know, like, okay, let's use this record right here. And that brought us to using one of the new songs off my album. Actually, is going to close out the ballet. They happen to be in here one night late. So they do the night owl thing too, late. And I was working on a record, and I was like, oh my God, what is that? I was like, this is new. And they was like, you think it's just something else?
Big Boy believes so much in the collaboration that he's unveiling a song off of his unreleased album. But can Outkast music really bring a new audience to the ballet? One thing is obvious. This is not the Nutcracker.
Right. Yeah, they come see me. Because the only ballet experience I've ever had was the Nutcracker when I was in elementary school. And like now, to have my own show, story, interpretation of just vibes and positive energy, like, I love it. I thrive off of that, for sure.
For NPR News, I'm Shereen Meraji.
Big Boy was talking all about his new track, but you can't hear it unless you go to Atlanta's Fox Theater tomorrow night to see the show.
If you can't make it, go to our website, npr.org, to see photos of the dancers in action. Our program is produced by Chip Grabo and edited by Martha Little. The director is Kiman Song.
The day-to-day production staff includes Catherine Fox, Steve Prophet, Deborah Clark, Shereen Meraji, Martina Castro, Vanessa Romo, Allison Gilbert, Ronnie Radville, and Jolie Myers. And special thanks this week to Javon Paris for additional production help.
Our editors are Jacob Conrad, Jason DeRose, Laura Dine, and Jim Wallace. Our technical director is Leo Del Aguila with engineer Sean Corey Campbell.
The day-to-day theme was composed by Greg Smith. Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Cohen.
My daughter, my baby mama, all escaping me. Like when she was my friend, like Princess died before she died, therefore we tried and tried again. But in the end, you pay attention to the pluses, but the minuses behind it make it seem like you can't win.